You are now listening to Macrodose.
Hello and welcome to Macrodose, a podcast hosted by me, James Meadway, that brings you your weekly fix of everything economics in a quick 15-minute roundup. Each Wednesday morning, we bring you the key stories making the news, and the analysis you need to make sense of them. On today's episode, we'll take a look at, first, a new report over in the US which lays out the climate risks to nuclear power. Second, it's back to the AI hype, and we'll have a look at how the scarcity of data is likely to squash the dreams of machine learning. And finally, we end on a positive note, looking at a new campaign for basic income for farmers. Time for our first story this week, the future of nuclear power and climate change. Last week, over in the United States, a report was submitted to Congress warning that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that's the US's independent agency tasked with protecting public health and safety when it comes to nuclear energy, should, quote, take actions to fully consider the potential effects of climate change, unquote. The report by the General Accountability Office found that the US's fleet of 75 operational and shuttered nuclear power plants were located in areas of high risk from the effects of heat, drought and wildfires, or of course all three. But the Accountability Office found that the Regulatory Commission, which oversees plant safety from design to operation, has simply been ignoring the likely effects of climate change on nuclear power. Now, this is certainly not the first warning of this kind. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission published another report after the catastrophe of Fukushima in 2011, which found that, as Bloomberg reported, 54 US nuclear power plants, even back then, were not built with adequate protections. Once again, the issue here is institutions failing to take account of climate change in their models and forecasts. Essentially, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission only looks at historic data when assessing risk to power plants, not projections of likely future changes. The result is nuclear power plants that have then been left perilously exposed to the effects of climate change. Now, it has to be said that discussions of nuclear power always stir up very heated debates, so I want to say up front that my starting point in nuclear energy is to be basically pretty agnostic. There are long-standing, well-known criticisms of using nuclear power from the environmental movement. In fact, it's fair to argue that the modern environmental movement, at least in Europe, developed in response to nuclear power. And of course, a set of disasters at nuclear plants over a few decades added fuel rods to the anti-nuke cause. Chernobyl in 1986 and Fukushima in 2011 are the best known globally and the most serious disasters to date. But that list also includes Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, USA, 1979, and Windscale in Cumbria, Northern England in 1957, in which a fire at one of the two reactor piles caused a leak of radioactive material over the UK and then the rest of Europe. That latter was one of the world's worst nuclear accidents at the time and is believed to have been responsible for 240 cancer deaths over subsequent years. But as in the Soviet Union, three decades later, the British government at the time attempted a substantial cover-up, which is partly why the Windscale site today is better known as Sellafield. Windscale was itself purpose-built to reprocess the fuel needed for Britain's nuclear weapons programme, and the close association between nuclear power and nuclear weaponry was another reason to oppose civilian nuclear power. Throw in the problems of long-term waste disposal and the monumental cost of decommissioning a plant once it reaches the end of its life, and the case against nuclear power is significant. All that said, the technology has improved substantially over the decades. The 60 or so plants being built today around the world are not the same design as Chernobyl, which began construction over 50 years ago. Safety and efficiency in terms of waste produced have both improved over time. Around 10% of the world's electricity generated presently comes from nuclear, and given the significantly lower, if not zero, carbon emissions from nuclear power, that represents a significant reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, estimated by the International Energy Authority to have been equivalent to 60 gigatons saved over the last 50 years, or equivalent to about 2 years' worth of current global emissions, even with the decline in nuclear use in recent decades. Given the increasing reliance on more intermittent sources of electricity from renewables, there's a growing need for a stable power source to provide the consistent base generation for electricity grids around the world, something that nuclear power is inherently good at providing. So in the balance between costs and benefits, as we think about decarbonising electricity systems over time, that's where the case is to be made for nuclear power. And indeed, bodies like the European Union have happily qualified it as a clean technology. Now, that was the idea behind a kind of eco-modernism. By swapping out fossil fuels for nuclear energy, we could essentially support ourselves through the transition to renewables using a relatively emission-free technology. And from a progressive perspective, that would buy us time to make significant changes to how and what we consume and how we live our lives. However, in reality, it doesn't seem all that simple. There is something that I first remember picking up on a few years back, which was the peculiar story in 2013 about a swarm of jellyfish shutting down one of the world's largest nuclear power plants at Oskarshamn in Sweden by clogging up its water intakes. Jellyfish populations have been exploding in recent years, which appears to be linked to climate change. As carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere rise, ocean waters have become warmer and more acidic. This is bad for most sea life, but wonderful for jellyfish, who have been breeding like crazy, resulting in these swarms that then clog up nuclear power plants across the globe. Shoreline nuclear plants in Israel, Japan, the United States, the Philippines, South Korea have all been affected in the last few years. Scotland's only remaining nuclear power plant at Torres has been forced to shut down so often that they've applied for a drone licence to monitor incoming swarms and provide a kind of early warning system. Now, the issue here isn't that a swarm of jellyfish clogging an intake pipe are likely to set off a second Chernobyl. It's that the efficiency of the plant is worsening over time as a result of climate change. I've covered this kind of issue a few times here in Macrodose. I remember during the heatwave of 2022, when the French nuclear power plants were powered down due to rising temperature of river water. Rather than jellyfish, the problem there was that the river water had become too hot to allow the power plants to run at full capacity. With France acting as a massive provider of electricity to the rest of Europe, exporting about the entire power consumption of Portugal last year alone, power downs in its reactors directly contributed to rising European energy prices over that year. And what did the French government do in response? They waived the stringent environmental safety rules governing water temperatures power plants could pump back into the rivers. When the river water going into the nuclear power plant is already hotter than normal, the water coming out of the nuclear power plant is warmer still, and usually this would be subject to strict regulations. Ignore the regulations, and the plants can dump as much hot water into the river as they want, with potentially deadly consequences for local wildlife. What links both of these stories, the jellyfish blockages and the rising river temperatures, is not that nuclear power plants are necessarily going to experience immediate disasters as a result of climate change. It's more that these very big, complex pieces of machinery are unusually vulnerable to the day-to-day impacts of climate change, the steady grind of everything typically becoming harder, more unpleasant, and more expensive than it used to be. This is the fundamental and growing background noise of climate change and nature crises as we experience them. So research published in Nature Energy from 2021 reckons that, I quote, the average frequency of climate-induced disruptions has dramatically increased from 0.2 outage per reactor year in the 1990s to 1.5 in the past decade. And this is only forecast to increase, adding up to many gigawatts of lost nuclear power capacity over the next few decades. The technology writer Cory Doctorow coined a useful term to describe the way the internet has steadily become worse and more useless over time. He calls it the enshittification of what were otherwise once useful tools. What climate change threatens, mostly, isn't some final don't-look-up-style cataclysm or even repeats of Chernobyl, although there is clearly a risk here, but the enshittification of everything. Day-to-day, things will cost more, fail more often, and not work in the ways we have become accustomed to. In a world working like this, big, complex bits of kit like nuclear power are increasingly vulnerable. What seems on the face of it to be minor stories about jellyfish or river temperatures thus begin to add up and become really substantial disruptions, ones that spell an end to the world of cheap nature as we once knew it. From nuclear power plants to large, complex systems like the global semiconductor supply chain or the worldwide agriculture system, it is absolutely vital that we centre and plan for worsening climate change in any and all economic models of our future. On to our second story today. Back to the AI hype and its clash with the realities of scarcity. Continuing with the enshittification theme of today's show, I wanted to turn now to a report published this week in the Wall Street Journal, which raises the alarm on the AI industry and its data consumption. We covered this back in last week's show, discussing how what we call artificial intelligence is really an extension of the data economy we've built up over the last two decades or so, and how the resource consumption needed to fuel those systems is playing out in basically colonial dynamics across the world. This week, I wanted to focus in not on the energy or water consumption of these systems, but on the data itself. Machine learning takes enormous quantities of information and looks for patterns in it that can be used to produce what are, for us, startlingly convincing results, sustaining what appears to be a conversation, inventing new videos from the old, and so on. To do this, the systems need very, very large quantities of ideally high-quality data generated by humans, things like the billions of words in Wikipedia or Reddit, for instance, that have been fed by OpenAI into its ChatGPT system. These words and phrases are broken up into what are called tokens and fed into the system, which then searches for correlations to produce what the system thinks we will see as sensible results. Thousands of contractors are used to feed this raw data into the machine and train it, often incredibly badly paid and insecure, with Time magazine reporting that OpenAI was paying Kenyan contractors less than $2 an hour to train its systems. Now, the Wall Street Journal quotes some figures on the volume of data needed to get us here. The current version of ChatGPT, GPT-4, used around 12 trillion tokens to get up to speed, producing bad poetry and all the rest of it. But the more complex the comparisons being made, the more raw data needs to be fed into the system. The journal quotes an estimate by AI researcher Pablo Villalobos that the next generation, ChatGPT-5, will need 60 to 100 trillion tokens based on current growth rates, or in other words, at least five times as much data again. Given these growth rates, Villalobos reckons that there is a 90% chance AI systems will run out of data by 2026. Approaching this limit, AI companies have started scrabbling around for solutions, including feeding their machines with data that has already been machine-generated. The problem here is what AI researchers coined as bot shit in a paper last year, that AI systems just generate, alongside actually impressive results in certain contexts, a great deal of superficially impressive nonsense. Think of all those made-up citations ChatGPT tends to produce if it's asked to write new research, or the inability of AI image generation tools to draw proper human hands. As this superficially impressive but actually meaningless output has got easier to produce, the internet is steadily getting flooded with it. There's a hefty business incentive to try and produce new content, and the cost of running AI to produce seemingly new content is so much lower than asking a human to do it that there are now endless websites regurgitating often nonsense text. A spectacular recent example of this was the AI-designed Willy Wonka experience in Glasgow, which was so awful that punters actually called the police and the organisers. But if you're taking this crappy AI-generated content and feeding it back into the AI machine, you're just going to get worse and worse results. The old principle of garbage in, garbage out, or as Cory Doctorow called it, coprophagic AI, an inhuman centipede, a machine that consumes its own crap to produce more crap. It's another example of how AI as we currently have it is an extractive industry in two dimensions. First, as we covered last week, it requires incredible real-world resources to function, from the huge numbers of semiconductors to the energy and water demands of the data centres. And second, in the processing of human data to produce results humans will appreciate. Because it is fundamentally extractive, it also means that the industry will hit limits and suffer from the same kind of economics as other extractive industries. That basically it gets harder and more costly to produce the output as the cheap, easy, high-quality seams of the raw material are used up. In the case of AI, the limit is the amount of sufficiently high-quality human data rather than the amount of readily available oil or high-quality farmland. What's impressive here is the report that AI might already be hitting the limits of data availability as soon as 2026. And as Ed Zitron, in his much-recommended newsletter Where's Your Ed At?, points out, the economic implication of this is that the sorts of insane valuations AI is starting to attract For example, in the explosion in the share price of NVIDIA, which designs the building block chips for machine learning, or in the projection of a $7 trillion investment by OpenAI's Sam Altman. These valuations cannot actually correspond to reality. There simply isn't enough data out there to justify the sorts of inflated values attached to AI companies. They won't be able to grow enough to make those valuations actually make sense. In other words, AI is a bubble, an enormously big one. This doesn't mean it won't have an impact, like other bubbles under capitalism, from railway mania, which built the British railway system, to the dot-com bubble that laid the foundations of the modern internet. But AI can't be the utterly transformational technology it gets hyped up as. At some point, the bubble will burst. The hard part is knowing when to get out. Our third and final story this week is a bit of good news, or at least something that points towards a better future, and that's the launch of a new campaign by British farmers for a basic income. We've picked up on basic income as a fundamental solution on Macrodose before, and for a deeper dive you can check out our episode UBI versus UBS on the arguments for a universal basic income and universal basic services. Essentially, in a world subject to repeated, unpredictable but costly shocks, such as those produced by worsening extreme weather events, guaranteeing everyone an income provides a fair form of insurance against this deep uncertainty. It gets out of trying to think about who deserves what, or about what kind of shocks warrant insurance, and provides an immediate safety net to everyone. Farming, perhaps more than any other part of the economy, is more exposed to exactly these sorts of shocks, and we've seen over the last few years how various droughts, floods, sometimes plagues of locusts are becoming more serious and more frequent, directly impacting farmers. Typically, it's the smaller farmers with the least to cushion themselves who get worst hit by this. That's starting to produce political impacts already. And perversely, it's been protest movements often colonised by the radical right against costly environmental policies that have been making the running in Europe. I say perversely, but it's also understandable for smaller farmers why they are aggrieved. The balance of subsidies and support in the EU, for instance, is notoriously skewed towards big agribusinesses and richer farmers, with 80% of common agricultural policy spending going to 20% of farms, typically the bigger ones. And climate change policy has been dominated by various forms of bad technocratic thinking that sees things like establishing a carbon price as the solution to climate change, when in reality this results in rising costs for those least able to support them. As climate change worsens, these sorts of arguments over who pays for it are going to be at the cutting edge of politics. So it's great to see a positive alternative being put together here in Britain. In alliance with our friends at the think tank Autonomy, Basic Income for Farmers have published a report sowing the seeds of stability to launch their campaign, highlighting the specific difficulties faced by smaller farms in Britain and how a basic income might help. It's a great start. It gets a positive, reasoned alternative into a debate on how to adapt to climate change. I'll link to the report in the show notes, and you can find Basic Income for Farmers on Twitter and Instagram if you want to show your support. And one final plug to end today's show. If you're interested in hearing more about how we finance the transition to clean energy and support those worst affected, I really do recommend last week's Macrodose Roundtable with Brett Christophers and Adrian Buller. We talked about market failures, maladaptation, and the future of economics, growth or degrowth. You can find that episode over on our new YouTube channel, or as usual, right here, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening to today's show. Macrodose is a Planet B production. If you enjoyed the show and you'd recommend it to friends, please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes, including our bonus interview content, on our Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose.